explanations for how the universe could be eternally old and still keep producing these things. And this was called steady state theory. And here were some of its originators. There's Fred Hoyle, who did not like the Big Bang. He's the one who came up with that term. Herman Bondi, a fellow named Gold, and then another fellow you're going to see in a little bit, named Jeffrey Burbidge, who I have the distinction of meeting in my work at UC San Diego. Now, what's kind of neat is that within memorable history, this all began to kind of fall apart. And it began in the 1920s with this fellow right here. This is Georges Lemaître, and some of you may be familiar with that name. He was a Catholic priest. He was an incredibly good cosmologist and mathematician, and he was one of the first to solve Einstein's general relativity field equations, which was a very hard thing to do. And what he found in that solution was that the universe was not just this static place, but that it was changing, that it was either expanding or contracting. This was a big deal. This was the first scientific in any way inkling that the universe might not be eternal. Now, not long after, you had Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope is named. He and his assistant, Humason, did some observations at the Melville telescope. They looked at lots and lots of galaxies, distant galaxies, and noticed that they all seemed to be brushing away from each other. It looked like the universe is doing this. And so the reasoning was, if you look at that going backward in time, while these galaxies are not rushing away from each other, they're coming towards each other, there must be a beginning point at which all that started. So that was pretty interesting. Then you have Martin Ryle with his observations of the changing universe from his radio survey. And then most importantly, you have these two fellows here. This is Arnold Penzias and Robert Wilson, who discovered the cosmic microwave background. And this is the instrument that they used to discover that. It's this big antenna in New Jersey. And this is pretty much what killed steady state forever. Okay, so this was in the late 1960s. And what's kind of interesting is that the Big Bang theory, and so this is a theory that Georges Lemaître had helped to develop, and that's why he's known as the father of the Big Bang. But one of the main predictions of this theory is that there was this Big Bang event, this sudden, very hot, energetic beginning to the universe, that there ought to be leftover energy from that universe, kind of an echo of the Big Bang just pervading the entire universe. And that by now would be in the microwave part of the spectrum. Well, you know, they looked for that for a long time, and these fellows were the ones who found it quite by accident. They had set up this antenna to look for something else, and they found that no matter where they pointed this antenna, they would get this uniform sort of background noise. And so, what in the world is this? And they couldn't figure it out. Is it a malfunction of the equipment? Is it some kind of terrestrial source? And one of my favorite stories is they even got in the antenna and were scraping off bird poop because they thought the pigeon droppings might have been creating this signal. And they finally realized that it was the long sought after echo of the Big Bang. And here is an all sky map of it from the WMAP survey. Now the contrast on this has turned up very high. It's in fact incredibly uniform throughout the sky. No matter where you look in the universe, it is the same to about one part in 100,000. This is the leftover radiation from the Big Bang. And the kind of the neat thing is it's just everywhere all the time. It's going through you right now. We're literally bathed in the light of creation. I just absolutely love that. So this was kind of it. The steady state was dead at this point. This was the strongest evidence you could find in favor of the Big Bang. Steady state theory could not explain it. Now, what I also like about this is Arnold Penzias was a religious man, he's Jewish. And so this is how he responded, you know. He said, I think it's Psalm 19, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. That is, God reveals himself in all there is. All reality to a greater or lesser extent reveals the purpose of God. I love that, that a God believer made one of the most momentous discoveries in the history of science. That's really neat. Now, this view wasn't shared by all scientists. You had atheists who absolutely hated it. This was a not uncommon sentiment here. This is John Maddox saying Big Bang theory is philosophically unacceptable. Now, he was, for many years, the editor of a very prestigious science magazine called Nature. And this is what he thought. You know, he was an atheist. He didn't like it for obvious reasons. If you have a beginning to the universe, you must have a beginner. And that's what this talk is going to be about. And I will say, in some sense, there's another sense in which atheists didn't like the Big Bang. It is philosophically messy in terms of there is a point at which we can't go past in our scrutiny. There's this open, messy end, this beginning, that no matter how close you think you can get, you're never going to quite get there, and that bugs people. So even apart from the religious considerations, those are the reasons that atheists hate it. But this is a great quote. This is Jeffrey Burbidge, one of the steady state guys. My fellow astronomers are rushing off to join the First Church of Christ at the Big Bang. They understood the philosophical implications of the Big Bang. Nobody understood this better than atheists at that time. Nevertheless, the evidence was so strong that it just became the accepted paradigm in physics that you had this, this Big Bang beginning to the universe. So this is a pretty typical graphic. You know, when popular magazines like to show how you can maybe visualize the history of the universe in the Big Bang, you think of time running along this direction, and then it just shows how the universe has changed with time. So there's the beginning there. Then you've got matter forming, you've got the first stars are forming, then you've got galaxies, and we're moving towards the present day. It's just kind of a nifty way to visualize that. Okay, but it brings up the obvious problem of, here's a universe that began to exist. Something caused it, something outside of the universe. What was it? Now, the popular interpretation back in the 1960s was God. It was obvious, right? And there really weren't any other contenders at that time. So thus we have, here's another headline I like. How It All Began Fits In With Bible Stories. The Bible Stories. So those are two actual headlines that showed up in London in the evening newspapers in the 1960s. Okay, so scientifically, that's where we're at. We're still there. But philosophically, people kind of dropped that whole discussion for a while until you had a young philosophy student named William Lane Craig, which I'm sure is a name that's well known here. In the 1970s, as a graduate student in England, decided to, let's talk about the philosophical aspect of this. Again, he wanted to kind of go back and look at this age-old struggle between the Greek view and the Genesis view. And what he discovered was something that he called the Kalam cosmological argument that goes back to medieval times. And Kalam is just the Arabic word that I think it means medieval theology. So it's an old theological argument for God. And so this is how he frames it. And it's got, we've got 3 points here. The first premise is that which begins to exist has a cause. Two, the universe began to exist. Therefore, deductively, you can say the universe has a cause. It's very simple. Now, this is one thing that I'm going to admonish you to commit to memory. Because atheists hate this argument. You'll see these quotes, and they can't get away from it. It pops up all the time now. And they hate it because the logic is impeccable. Okay, so you can't get around the logic, which is flawless. So, as Craig points out, what they do instead, what atheists do, is they attack the first two premises. So we'll talk about this. That which begins to exist has a cause, and then the universe began to exist. So they'll attack those and try to discredit one or both of those, and then, you know, in that way it kind of destroys the third point. So let's talk about these. Okay, that which begins to exist has a cause. So atheists will counter, this is their favorite counter to this, is that they'll invoke quantum randomness. Now it's kind of a powerful thing because most people who don't have training in physics, they see anything to do with quantum physics, and they recoil because it's weird and it's hard to understand. And people with a superficial understanding of it can try to make convincing sounding arguments. And so what they'll do is something like this. They'll say, okay, we have this process, for instance, called alpha decay. This is where you take a really heavy atom, nucleus, like uranium-238, and you'll get a spontaneous emission of an alpha particle, which is just a helium nucleus. And then you'll get some other particle left over like thorium. Okay, now it's true that we can't predict precisely when, if you have just a given atom, you don't know for sure when that decay is going to happen. But that doesn't mean that it's causeless, okay? It does have a cause. So anytime that you have a set of conditions that need to be met in order for something to happen, it has a cause. So we have a weak nuclear force that governs, you know, events like this. And then also, it only happens when you have too many protons in a nucleus. You don't have the sort of spontaneous emission with smaller atoms. Okay, so it's not causeless. And, you know, it's funny that they'll say, well, you know, you can be skeptical that the universe, that which begins to exist has a cause on this basis because quantum things seem to be causeless. But do you notice that they never invoke that argument to say, well, just cheeseburgers could pop into existence, or fire trucks, or aardvarks, or kitchen sinks, or even entire planets? Nobody argues for that, right? But yet, they will invoke it to say that an entire universe, as enormous and filled with mass and energy and as complex as ours, could just pop into existence without a cause. It's absurd. So, you know, we can do away with that counter-argument. Number two, they try to attack the idea that the universe began to exist. Now, the problem for them is that the Big Bang is pretty much about as solid scientifically as you can get, which is not to say that we have absolute proof, but in terms of the evidence, we're there. There's not a lot of people who are saying that we don't understand this well. Okay, so the way that this works is, okay, they have to factor in that we do have these observations very strongly pointing to a beginning in the universe. So instead they say, well, let's take it back to the old cyclical universe. So maybe that Big Bang was just one of an infinite number of Big Bangs. The universe will have a beginning, it will expand, and then at some point it will contract, and then you'll get a big crunch, which will kick off another Big Bang. So this just happens, bang, crunch, for eternity. Okay, so in this sense, you don't really have a true beginning, you know, it just goes on and on. And there's another one, which is this idea that maybe this universe sort of quantum bubbled out of some meta-universe, you know, that in another space, with quantum mechanical rules, this universe just popped into existence randomly. Or here, you know, you've seen kind of these cone diagrams, I just showed you one. Well, what if there's a past beyond that beginning point, you know? So that really the universe doesn't have a beginning. They try all these different things. Mathematically, you know, this was in the headlines a while back. Well, we can just speculate mathematically that maybe the universe didn't have a beginning. You know, but they're obviously trying to attack the second premise. But unfortunately for them, really it just doesn't work. So this is from about 6 years ago. This is from the MIT Technology Review, and so this coincided with the 70th birthday celebration of Stephen Hawking, and they held a symposium in his honor. And it was at the symposium that Alexander Blinken, who's one of the world's leading cosmologists, said, guys, give it up. We are never going to get around the beginning. All of these ideas that we come up with to try to get around the beginning end up, even in terms of the math, failing. So this idea, like this, is that the universe can just have these infinite big things and big crunches, doesn't work. The mathematics of that, it just doesn't work out because, for instance, every time you have a crunch and another big bang, you increase the amount of disorder that's in the universe. Okay? So you have this quantity called entropy, it's how much chaos or disorder there is. And our universe, one of the big mysteries in physics is the fact that our universe had such low disorder when it was created. We don't know why that was the case scientifically, but it was very ordered. What you would expect after an infinite number of bangs and crunches is that the entropy would be at maximum because this has already happened an infinite number of times. But obviously that's not the case. And so on this basis, you can rule out those kinds of universes. Alexander Blinken said, we are stuck. Okay, so
evidence from, I remember Hugh Ross kept talking about a Lawrence Krauss paper in which he proved that the expanding universe would continue to expand to the point where no heat or light from any object will ever touch another object. And he kind of poo-pooed the idea that there was a crunch. It was like an expansion into nothingness.
So that's a good point. We call that the heat death of the universe. And so that's even if you could show that the universe would undergo a contraction, somebody doesn't look like it.
No.
The evidence we have is that the universe is accelerating its expansion, it's speeding up. We don't see any sign that it's going to halt and then start contracting. And in fact, if it keeps going like this, right, what's going to happen is the universe is going to stretch so much that you're going to get to a point where all that's left of the universe is cold gas, dead black holes, and dead husks of burned out stars. It's effectively going to be a dead universe. So you have to keep in mind, every time an atheist challenges something like this, well, maybe the universe didn't have a beginning. It's speculation, it's pure speculation. They don't have any real arguments for it. They're trying to throw you off balance. Derek, you had a question?
Yeah, I was just curious, is it a valid argument to say that we see that the expansion is accelerating, but how would they avoid countering with saying we just happen to be coincidentally in the acceleration phase of that expansion?
And you, it would you can't be, rule that out.
Huh?
You can't rule that out. It could be, yeah, that you have different phases where you have like inflation, a period of rapid expansion, that it kind of levels off and it starts to accelerate. You can't definitively rule out that the crunch wouldn't happen, right? But the point is we don't see any evidence for it. It's not like, well, if you look up here, if it keeps going this way, we're headed for a crunch. They're just speculating. It's not based on evidence. It's not based on anything mathematical that takes into account these refutations that say, sorry, we are stuck for the beginning. And so William Lane Craig has used this in his talks, and he even corresponded with the Lincoln and said, have I represented your work fairly? And the Lincoln said, yes, this is the way it is. So in addition to memorizing these points of the cosmological argument, remember these refutations. You're stuck at the beginning, okay? And quantum randomness does not mean that there's no such thing as a cause, okay? So, now, we're at the point where science has accepted the supernatural. This is another comeback. I like to use this on atheists all the time. I ask them, do you accept that the Big Bang has happened? Oh, yeah. Well, then you accept the supernatural. No, I don't. No. And, but you walk them through it. So this is what you do. Super is just a Latin word meaning beyond or above. Nature means that which is natural, which is in the universe. So whatever is the cause of the universe must be beyond the universe. It is therefore supernatural. You can kind of get rid of that baggage of where people think of ghosts and angels and whatever, but literally speaking, there is a supernatural cause to the universe. So now, atheist scientists, they're not actually thinking about this, the smart ones, and so they come up with alternatives, like the multiverse, and so this is kind of one way to think about how the multiverse looks. You know, you get these different universes that are causally disconnected from each other. They kind of just bubble into existence, right? We don't have any evidence for this. This is, again, just speculation. And it just so happens that ours popped into existence with all the right parameters for life, which I will be talking about in 2 weeks from now. And so just, you know, if you have an infinite number of these universes in the multiverse, then you're bound to come up with something like what we have. Or here's another one. This is kind of gaining popularity in the physics world, the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics. And so any of you who are fans of the old Star Trek series, they kind of explored this a little bit. You know, they have the Bearded Spock episode where they're in this alternate Star Trek universe. And it's this idea that every time there's a situation that can go one way or another or a million different ways, each of those realities is realized but by the universe kind of peeling off and you have another universe. So at this juncture, let's say you've got a man who's asking a woman on a date. She can either say yes or no. Well, the many worlds people say the universe actually splits into two universes, one where she says yes, one where she says no, and then into those splits, and on it goes, and on it goes. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. And this is one way that, that people try to deal with the weirdness of the quantum world. But it's, I mean, to me, it's absurd. But this is one flavor of the multiverse. And so this is supposed to take away, you know, this notion that we have a beginning, that the universe is caused by something intelligent.
Don't these quantum theories require multiple dimensions beyond four that we're bound by?
So there is, yeah. So in string theory, which you, when you do have many, many multiple dimensions, and that does tie in to the multiverse. There are different kinds of multiverse. I should, one of these days I could give a talk about that. Yes, I actually think string theory is kind of nifty, but I don't, I think it actually is even more evidence in favor of God.
But it's all based on?
Some of it, this is
theory that can't be proven.
Yes, that cannot currently be tested by any means that we know of, and for the foreseeable future cannot be tested, because it involves dimensions that are so small that they're beyond any technology that we could even ever conceive of. But, you know, that's, so it's mathematical and speculative. I'd say it's good, interesting philosophy. It's not really science. But this is, you know, this is where things stand in terms of the science right now. The universe had a supernatural cause. Christians say it was God. Atheists say, well, maybe it was the multiverse. These are the only serious contenders. Okay. Now, at this point, without even understanding what the multiverse is, there's a way to just, you know, if you ever have this question from a non-believer friend, or if your children or grandchildren come to you with this, you can just get around it. You don't even need to know anything about the science of the multiverse, which I can just tell you there are so many problems with the multiverse that even on that basis, to me, it's not really credible. But here's how you get around it. The best explanation for the universe is that it had a personal cause. Now, I'm sure that you all understand what I mean when I say personal, meaning that whatever the cause was, it was person-like. It had characteristics of a person, meaning consciousness and volition. What was kind of funny is that I had an encounter on social media with an atheist. We were talking about this stuff, and I can't remember, it was a discussion of saying, well, you know, Christians tend to think of these things in terms of personal causes. And he said, typical theist, you guys are only thinking about yourselves. And I realized he thought I meant personal, like personal to me, like my own personal God. And I suddenly realized why so many atheists I talk to object to that term, my personal God. It's like, I'm saying he's my God, my own, you know. And no, I told him, no, we mean that he has the characteristics of a person as opposed to something that's just abstract. So, you know, you never know what kind of assumptions people are making when you're talking to them. Now, the question is why? Why is the best explanation a personal cause? Let's take what we know about the universe. Okay. Because the universe is bound in time and it changes, whatever is beyond the universe is outside of time. It is therefore timeless and changeless. Matter and space came into being when the universe was created. Therefore, whatever is beyond the universe, that cause, has to be immaterial and spaceless. Okay, and given the fact that the universe is what it is, incredibly complex, and especially I would argue that human beings, that conscious human beings, are the most incredibly complex thing that there is in the universe, whatever made it must be immensely powerful. Now, if we just take those first two things, timeless, immaterial, spaceless, okay. Well, what does this sound like? As Christians, we already know what this sounds like to us. But could be abstract objects. If you neglect that third point, you know, these are things that are timeless, changeless, immaterial, spaceless. The problem is, I mean, this is it. It's either an abstract object or it's something personal, right? The problem is that abstract objects don't have any causal power. They can't, the number seven can't cause something to happen. Okay. So all we're left with is a personal being. And the best one that, of all the the multiverse, to be able to argue someone to that point, to say, okay, we have a Big Bang, we have a cause to the universe that's outside of the universe, we can, you know, in terms of logic, we can say it must have these properties. Well, what does that sound like? It's either abstract objects or it's some kind of personal being with volition who can will these things to happen. That's God. So at that point, then you've got an interesting discussion. Is it God? We can talk about that. So I do encourage you to memorize that long cosmological argument. I'm going to put this on the website so that you guys can look over my slides and my notes. Just memorize those three premises, okay? And then you can come back with, you know, if they try to challenge any of those premises, well, there are good responses to those. The quantum world doesn't mean things are without cause, okay? And then what was the second one? That, oh, we can't get around the beginning to the universe. So I'll just summarize this for you. What you should take away from the talk today, for millennia, the scientific view was that the universe was eternal. So this was great for atheists, for non-Christians, because it supported their beliefs. It didn't support ours. This was a problem, obviously, because the straightforward reading of Genesis 1 is that the universe has a beginning. Well, this changed in the mid-20th century with all of the evidence that pointed to a Big Bang. The Big Bang is your friend. Atheists understood this in the 1960s, which is why they hated it. They still don't like it, but now they're kind of thinking, well, Christians are, they don't really like it either, so they kind of just go with that. But the Big Bang is your friend. The Big Bang sounds exactly like Genesis 1:1. It's like Dr. Pony the previous week said, when he's talking about things, when you look at things that are said in the Bible, you have to think, how would that actually look? If we're looking at that event that's described in Genesis, what would you expect to see? Well, with the Big Bang, we're talking about a very sudden, highly energetic, there's the universe. We're talking about Genesis 1:1. Isn't that exactly what it's talking about? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Okay, the Big Bang, the best part, undeniably implies some kind of supernatural cause for the universe. So now the question is it conscious or is it unconscious? And you can talk about the fact that that cause, from all that we know about the universe, and using logic, we can say that the best explanation for that is God. So I think with this one, you've got a great conversation starter, or you've got a great response to anybody who's having doubts. Okay? So at this point, I'm open to take questions. Any of you who need to leave, just feel free to walk out at this point. But anyone who wants to stick around and talk about this some more, please do.
Should be lots of questions.
I'm sorry?
There should be lots of questions.
Unless I just explain this so well and have all the information that you need. So, yeah, here.
Before Penzias and Wilson, how prevalent was the notion of the Big Bang? Was it kind of like, was it, how accepted was it?
It was very much up for debate. It was highly debated at that point, and you had, from what I can tell, it was pretty evenly split between people who were on board with the Big Bang and those who said, no.
So it wasn't as kind of open and shut as, let's say, also in the 60s, from what I understand, the notion of no tectonic plate tectonics to bam, the next year. My geology professor told me that they went away one summer, they came back, and it was, that's the way it was.
That's, you know, that's probably how it was with the cosmic microwave background. It was such a momentous announcement that they had discovered this, and it was almost exactly at the energy level that they had predicted. And in terms of things like this, you say temperatures, because we measure the temperature of these things, it was within 1 degree of the predicted temperature for this. So, I mean, I think it was probably pretty sudden like that, that you had people who were divided about it, and then after the announcement of that background radiation, the echo of the Big Bang, because they'd been looking for this and they had been debating it, well, this is the prediction, it's going to be this temperature if we find it. and the fact that the steady staters didn't have a good explanation. They weren't prepared in the event that this would actually be discovered to have like a counter explanation. They had none. And there was other evidence that was piling up at that time too, which is kind of interesting. So that fellow back there who had that quip about the First Church of Christ at the Big Bang. So like I said, I met him when I was at UC San Diego. He's a very famous astrophysicist, at least in scientific circles, because he, along with his wife and dad, Fred Hoyle, had come up with this idea of stellar nucleosynthesis. It's this idea that heavier elements are manufactured inside of stars. So a lot of us learned about this in college or in science classes in high school. And so that's where it came from, was Burbidge and his colleagues, which was brilliant, it was wonderful. But it doesn't account for all of the heavy elements in the universe. You have, you know, you can take like a random big chunk of the universe. If you took like a big cube that was millions of light years on each side, you said, we're gonna sample how much stuff is in here. And that's kind of like sampling a population. You can get a sense of what the whole universe is like. And you find that there are certain proportions of hydrogen, helium, and then heavier elements, you know, you go in the periodic table. And what they found is that those proportions could not be explained by stellar nucleosynthesis alone. Something else had to account for it. The Big Bang is the best explanation for that. The fact that the universe was so hot, it was like a giant fusion reactor creating some of these heavier elements. The best explanation for that, those precise proportions that we measure, is the Big Bang. The steady state theory can't explain that. So there's a number of points. So those things were already piling up before the discovery of the background radiation. It left a little room for doubt, but once that microwave background was discovered, that was pretty much it.
Yeah,
it was very sudden.
Which I think pretty much answers my second question, which was after 68, was it 68?
69, I think, is when they announced it.
Whether it was, how, you know, how sealed was it? In other words, was there still a little bit of debate, or was it pretty much, like you just said, it pretty much ended it?
It pretty much ended it. You had people, I don't remember, I need to read it up on it. Fred Hoyle was a really interesting fellow, because he doubted evolution. Even though he's an atheist, he looked at it scientifically and mathematically and said, the numbers just don't work out. There's not enough time for these things to randomly give rise to life. And so he was a very honest man in that regard. And so I don't know if he ever came to change his mind about the Big Bang, but his colleague, Jeffrey Burbidge, never did. He died a few years ago, and as far as I know, he went to his grave denying that the Big Bang ever happened, or just, I should say, being skeptical of it. And skepticism is permitted in science. You need that. Nevertheless, in my opinion, I think he kind of damaged his credibility by just, he wasn't on board with how much sheer evidence there is, multiple independent lines of evidence all converging on the Big Bang. And I think it's because he was an atheist. He was a staunch atheist, and he just could not let go of that, because it would just lead to the implication that God created the universe. But really, you had very few people hanging on to steady state at that point. Yes?
Would you talk a little bit about the immaterial and out of time? Because from my perspective, when something looks frozen, and we talk about Einstein, it's all relative. Mm-hmm. So your frame of reference and where you start from informs your theories.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about what you're looking for.
Well, it's hard for me to grasp out of time, no time, because I don't think God is unchanging. And I don't think he's exactly where he was when the universe was created. If you say it's out of time, that says he's static. And that doesn't fit well. In my perspective.
Now that's an interesting point. So I'm kind of an acolyte of Gerald Schroeder, and I may have mentioned him before. He's an Orthodox Jewish physicist and also a theologian, and he wrote some wonderful books, Genesis and the Big Bang, The Science of God, and then God According to God, where he says, let's look at what God actually says about himself, and then also we can square that with science. And he actually does make the point that he does not think that God is changeless. He thinks that God is dynamic. And so there's a very well-known verse in the Bible where God says, I am what I am. That's the translation of my name. But Schroeder says, if you interpret the Hebrew more carefully, it says, I will be that which I will be, which he interprets as meaning that there is room there for God to change. So you're right, it may be that he changes, but does then that mean that he would have to change outside of time? So physicists, I don't know if all philosophers are on board with this, but physicists are all pretty much in agreement that time came into being with the Big Bang.
So our perception of time and what we consider time.
Yes. Now,
the question is, what's outside of that?
Yeah. It would be beyond time. Now, eternity, where things can still happen in the eternal sort of frame. What's kind of interesting is that, see, Einstein came up with relativity because he came up with this, he was thinking, I think it was that he was on a train, you know, because everybody traveled by train in Europe at that time. And he was thinking, you know, what if there was like a beam of light that was trekking along the train? If I could ride along with a photon, a particle of light, what would that be like? Well, it turns out that for energy, for pure energy, like a photon, exists in an eternal state of now because it travels at the speed of light. This is what we know mathematically from relativity theory, is that the closer you get to the speed of light, the more time that will slow down, to the point that if you could travel at the speed of light, you would be in an eternal state of now. So there are objects in this universe that are kind of experiencing eternity in a way, but that doesn't mean that they don't experience change and that they're not dynamic. I don't know how to answer your question conclusively because we can only really know our own experience, what we're in. I mean, it's like a baby trying to understand what's beyond the womb.
Didn't Einstein postulate that if you were going at the speed of light, then time wouldn't exist?
Right. Yes.
Because National Geographic has a series on Einstein, and I think the first episode he explains exactly what you said.
Yeah.
He's in a classroom explaining to students. But I recall him saying that time would stop.
Yeah.
So then,
to get to your point. Eternal now.
Right, yeah.
So it's eternal now. So the question of if there is a creator and he has to take action to create something,
mm-hmm.
How do we measure that? We measure things in terms of time. We start at one point. We do things over a period we call time. And something occurs.
I have wrestled with that. Now, Hugh Ross, those of you who've attended RTV meetings longer than I have may be able to answer this. I think Hugh Ross subscribes to the idea of another dimension of time along which God takes action. And I haven't studied that very much, so I couldn't tell. Is it explained in that book?
It's explained beyond the cosmos.
Okay, so that might be a good starting place.
Take a look, because
that I have not explored that idea very much.
So that I think they try to explain the other time you mentioned how God can move, how he knows all that has happened, and he can move to any point in time.
Okay.
You know, in the Bible, when he's in the pillar of light. Israelites.
I'm no scientist, but that makes perfect sense to me, because to me, a creator cannot be bound by that which he created.
Right.
Yes.
God has created everything.
Right.
And so, how would he be static if he?
So
he would have to be. He would not be a creator if he were static. In other words.
So. Yes, and that's an excellent point. That if he was changeless and static, then the universe ought to be eternal in that sense, right? Because at some point, whether you call that in time or, you know, according to God's will, he brought the universe into existence, he created it. That's a really good point.
I'm just trying to square your statements about out of time and immaterial.
He's out of whatever, so the time that governs this universe, he is definitely beyond that.
Okay,
but he's within it at the same time.
Right.
Well, yeah, in some sense, yes.
And I think that Ross even postulates something like 14 different dimensions, right? So once you start going beyond, we cannot understand a fourth dimension outside of space-time. But we can't put the fifth dimension. We can't understand it because we don't exist in that world.
Can we get back to our three dimensions,
yeah.
Four dimensions? I want to ask a question about the cosmic background radiation, that is purely a temperature, a minute temperature variations, is that correct? Of what?
One part in 100,000.
Okay, that's what it is. But you made a fun statement after that about how good it makes you feel that there's something that's still going through all of us.
So
what was that?
These photons, these are particles of light that are left over from the creation event. They pervade the universe. They're zipping around. They're zipping right through this room and right through you at every moment. That is the light of creation. We are constantly experiencing that. You know, we can't see it. We can't feel it. It's there.
So those are individual photons that are just racing through right this instant from the very beginning of creation.
We're experiencing it.
And we're experiencing it, right?
Is the neatest thing ever.
Is it photons or
the microwave? The
photons. So
the microwave wavelength?
Yes. So
microwave wavelength.
The electromagnetic spectrum. Light, the way that you characterize light is by how much energy it has. That's the only thing that we care about. But this corresponds to what color the light is or how hot the thing is that's emitting it. So like the sun about 6,000 degrees on its surface, and so it emits a color of light that corresponds to that temperature. So you can characterize it in terms of wavelength, frequency, or color. It's all kind of the same thing.
Okay.
And so we're used to the visible light part of the spectrum, which is just a tiny sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. From there it goes to ultraviolet, which is what gives us suntans, and wrinkles. We go to like X-rays, gamma rays, we get more and more energetic parts of the electromagnetic spectrum. It's really high energy, high temperature. Then you go the other way, and beyond the visible light spectrum, you have infrared. Everything glows in the infrared. This is how you use night vision goggles, for instance. Then it goes to microwave, radio emissions, and it just gets longer and longer wavelength, the more light wavelength gets stretched out. The more it goes in that direction on the spectrum. And so, radio part of the spectrum is we use radio waves to communicate. Microwaves, exactly like what you have in your microwave oven, it just means it's radiation that is generated by that little oven at a specific wavelength to jiggle the water molecules that are in your food. That's how it heats it up. It just jiggles the water molecules. And that friction, that energy, is what heats up your food. But we're surrounded, pervaded by microwave energy in the universe. So the idea is that when the Big Bang happened, the universe was so hot, so energetic, that there's nothing in there but energy, but photons. Okay, and it was so high energy that even matter couldn't form at that point. But as the universe expanded, it cooled off, the wavelengths of those photons got stretched out. So when a gas expands, it cools. It's just thermodynamics. We all kind of understand that. It expands, it cools, and so this is why the photons, they got less and less energetic as the universe expanded. They expand right along with the universe, their wavelengths, until you get to the less energetic parts of the spectrum. And today they predicted, the universe is at such and such scale. We can kind of measure these things. We'll just say the universe is at such and such scale. At the beginning, it's microscopic. It must have expanded a certain amount of in scale in that amount of time. Therefore, we can predict mathematically by how much those photons' wavelengths would get stretched out. So what part of the spectrum would that be in today? And they calculated it would be in the microwave part of the spectrum. I think they calculated 5 degrees Kelvin, which is just 5 degrees above absolute zero. It is so cooled off. And what they found was that it was about 4 degrees Kelvin. It's an amazing confirmation of that theory. So,
how do you have a collector or a microwave antenna that can detect one part in 100,000?
Well, so this came later with the Wilkinson.
Yeah, but even.
And so the. Yeah,
that's sensitive. What do you think?
It is incredibly sensitive.
I'm in the semiconductor industry, and we can't guarantee anything like that.
Oh, it's crazy. And then the things that they had to do to make sure that this was right, because the problem is that we're in a galaxy, and so you get you do get emission from the galaxy itself. And so when you look at, here, I'll go to the slide, when you look at uncorrected maps of the microwave background here, you see this big disk across here corresponding to the galaxy where all these microwave sources are in there, because water, we have a lot of water molecules in the galaxy and they vibrate and we can see them with these things, and so they have to subtract that out, and this is what's left over. But yeah, like you say, incredibly sensitive. Well, and this is part of the reason they had to launch this thing into space in order to make such accurate measurements to just beyond, be beyond these terrestrial sources. Yeah. That is an interesting point, yes.
So what did we say about the big bounce, the blue spot on the bottom?
So, yeah, they have these, it's like this great cold spot. And these, so the dark spots are where the temperature is a little bit cooler. The red spots are where the temperature is a little bit higher. And what they have found is that these hot spots and cold spots correspond to where you have structure and voids in the universe. So where it's cool, you have these voids. Okay, this stuff, but there's nothing. There's essentially nothing. And where you have these hot spots is where you have like galaxy clusters and just these huge structures. I don't know that anyone knows why we have such a big void right there.
But you'd expect that about a billion years from now, if the universe is still expanding, someone were to take an exact duplicate of this measurement, that dark blue spot would be bigger.
Yeah, think right.
Yeah.
So, excuse me, I wish I had a graphic of this. You can see these simulations of structure building in the universe as it expands, but it's like these filaments, it's like this kind of cobwebby sort of thing where, like, you know, really stringy cheese that's all melting as it expands, it just, right, those voids just get bigger and bigger. So the universe isn't just evenly populated with stuff. It's actually kind of all along these filaments and lines and things, and it's really neat looking. But yeah, you do get these great big voids just where there's nothing, and there are astronomers who study those voids to try to figure out what's going on there.
Sarah, what coordinate system for that? Am I looking at polar coordinates there or what?
So this is a type of map that I cannot remember what the name of it is. If you go to Wikipedia and just look up the CMB, it shows this map, it'll tell you what kind of map.
It's how, if you're inside a sphere, how you
can... Yeah, this is a two-dimensional representation.
It's an all-side view, so
everything,
and then somehow they figured out how to flatten that.
And, so and they had to correct for the Milky Way to subtract that out of it.
Yeah.
Don't go there.
Is there that anything that approaches the speed of light increases in mass?
Yes.
And once it hits the speed of light, it adds infinite mass.
Okay. Which is why there is a cosmic speed limit.
So theoretically, if God wanted to take on mass, he would be the only being who could go at the speed of light.
That's an interesting idea. I think you probably put that through. I don't know.
Well, think about it. If God is outside of the universe,
yeah.
Well, he permeates, right, as John said, but he's also outside. And you're praying to God, I mean, you're going, those prayers are going beyond the speed of light.
Yes. Right. You know, and this is just pure speculation, so don't quote me on this, but thinking about the Shroud of Turin, which I find very compelling, and Marty Pony, who gave the previous lecture, is quite interested. He gave a talk to the Christian Faculty Network at UT about this. I'm convinced this is the real deal. But thinking about how would that impression have been made on that piece of cloth, we wonder, at the point at which Jesus' body disappeared, did it just kind of approach light speed, and that's sort of the, you know, the energy imprint that was left on the shroud? It's kind of, my dad and I kind of like that idea, so we wonder. You know, the point at which he just sort of vanished from this universe after he died, you know, is that why we have that image on the shroud? So, I don't know.
That'd be Dr. Pony's next book, then, how that happened.
Maybe, yeah. I could collaborate since I know the energy part of that.
This also takes out all the galaxies, right?
I'm sorry?
This picture, it takes out all of the galaxies, not just the Milky Way.
Yeah, so any of, this will take out known microwave sources, so, you know, any sort of gas cloud or something that we know that would be a microwave source, because we just want the background. Oh, what are they doing over there?
They're stacking chairs. They're finished.
So was there, I saw, yes.
Yeah, I have a question. I don't think I quite caught the point you were making about the multi-group. Could you just recap what are the main weaknesses with the multi-group?
Oh yeah, I did skip over that. So there are different levels of multiverse. When you hear that word, it could mean one of four different things. So there's this idea that, you know, the simplest form of the multiverse is that you have parts of the universe within this universe that just expanded so quickly during that period called inflation that they effectively become causally disconnected from each other. They're so far apart that they can't communicate with each other, that they could be governed by different qualities, different parameters, and so effectively they're kind of a different universe. That's a very low-level multiverse. Then you have the idea that you have like bubble universes, and I think that's what I showed here. Let me pop this up.
So my question is, what are the weaknesses of that?
Yeah, so then I have to build up to that. So
okay.
Then you have the pocket universes or bubble universes where, during inflation, you effectively get just right, these different universes that are governed by different rules and different parameters. Then you've got the next level, which is the many worlds interpretation, and then there's even like a fourth level, which is somehow you've got this meta universe, this meta space that generates practically an infinity of universes. Nobody knows how, nobody knows what it is, but somehow it's generating like practically an infinite number of universes, each with different parameters, and just by sheer dumb luck, we, you know, occupy the one that has the parameters that are necessary for life. Okay, well, so the other ones, this is the one that is the weakest, because as we talked about, there's a philosophical and kind of practical problem with infinities. It's just absurd, for one thing. Where's the evidence for the multiverse? We don't have any evidence. Let's see, there's some other good arguments against those.
There's the 40 good blank, and anything that is expanding on average has to have a beginning.
Yes.
That applies even to
that
the multiverse.
That applies even to the multiverse, that anything that has a beginning, anything that is expanding has a beginning, so that it is subject to the same rules. Okay, so what created the multiverse then? All it does is it kicks the can a little bit. You don't solve the problem of what created the universe. You're just pushing it backwards and nobody notices it. Then there's this idea that even if you have an infinite set of multiverses of universes, they don't all have to be different. What if they're all exactly the same, right? I mean, do they even know by what mechanism it would, you know, like, this one has, you know, let's say the parameters are just right to have the right amount of gravity, the electromagnetic force is just right, we have the right number of dimensions. Maybe the next universe over has, you know, all of those parameters except for one. And maybe the next one over there has all of them except for two. I mean, do we know that? Why is this mechanism kicking out all these? I mean, it just goes on and on. And not even to rule, I mean, how does this even rule out God? You know, it's like something still has to kick all this into motion. So that's just scratching the surface of the problems with the multiverse. The problem with infinity is the problem that we can't test it. We don't have any evidence for it. The problem that it doesn't solve the problem of a beginning. It just pushes the problem back a level. So the multiverse doesn't solve anything. that's what I call a science-flavored idea. It's not really science. That is meant to kind of dazzle people who don't have a lot of background in science, and they kind of go, oh, okay, well, I don't understand this. I can't argue now.
Is the multiverse, though, supported by mathematics and physics, and that's where they get the...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I have to admit that it's not uncompelling. I mean, I kind of... The quantum thing, like the many worlds interpretation of universes keeps splitting and splitting and splitting and all this kind of stuff. Well, the math that leads up to that is compelling, but that doesn't mean it's true. I mean, the problem is that it comes from well-established, very well-tested physics in this universe, but they're extrapolating from that. And until you can test it, you can't say that, you know, is reality. There have been so many times, I need to start compiling a list, just in my field, where we expect, theoretically, something to go one way. Like, maybe we expect supernovas to behave a certain way based on theory and observation. And then we look at it as the complete opposite of what we expect. And now we have to explain, we were so sure that it was going to be this one way, and then the observations turn it on its head. That has happened more times than I can count. It's not science unless you can test it. So this is why I always come back to these skeptical people, but the people who throw the multiverse out there. Show me that it works. Show me what evidence you have.
Yeah, so we see the expansion of the universe, and we know that different galaxies are expanding because we can measure the shift.
I'm sorry, say that again. We know that...
They're expanding away from us.
Yes, right.
We can measure the Doppler shift.
Yeah.
Okay. So the time period that we're able to measure that shift is 50 last 50 years ago.
This about 100 years ago.
Okay, say 100 years. But that is like a snapshot of time because technological time period.
Yes.
So how do we rule out the expansion and contraction if we're just doing a snapshot?
We're doing a lot of snapshots. We're doing them in all...
Yeah, but it's so... When I say a snapshot, like over 100 years, that's not background. That could just be...
Oh, no, we're doing snapshots over billions of years, so we've been able to do this. You're not going to notice a whole lot of motion in the last 100 years of galaxies. You can with stars.
No. Okay.
So are you asking, like, we've got 100 years worth of snapshots of the universe? Is that kind of...
Well, I'm saying, if the universe is expanding and then going to contract, if that's over billions of years, then we would expect over 100 years or even a millennia that we wouldn't see much in that rate of change.
Well, you're not going to see any change in the last 100 years.
So how can we say that it's not going to contract later?
So what
that's
we
what
do,
I understand.
That's a good question, but what we do have is we can push observations back until just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. The idea is the universe is about 14 billion years old. We can look back in time directly with our telescopes to just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang. And we can take snapshots from then all the way up till now. And so, yeah, that's a good point. And then what we do is we say, okay, starting at time just a few hundred million years after the Big Bang, through billions of years, we have snapshots of what the universe has been doing. We can reconstruct that history, and we just look based on the past. Expansion went like this, and then it kind of leveled off, and then it accelerated. Okay, and so we see that history that looks like that. We're saying, well, we're just not seeing where at any point it might turn over. There's no suggestion that now it's starting to turn over and starting to collapse, so we don't see that. Can't rule it out, but we're just not seeing evidence of it. And in terms of the paradigm that explains all this is called cold dark matter. It's called lambda cold dark matter universe. The lambda is referring to dark energy, which is supposedly, you know, this force that is causing the exponential or the accelerated expansion of the universe. And so they have an explanation for why you have that sort of, why you have inflation, it kind of levels off, and then at some point, because the matter in the universe is getting diluted, you know, as you expand more and more, the dark energy takes over. It becomes the dominant force of the universe. And as far as we know, there's nothing else there.
And is that what they're talking about when they talk about the heat death of the universe?
No, so this is, well, the heat death is a consequence of this.
Okay.
But just talking about pure expansion, well, is the universe going to contract and then, or expand and then contract? I don't see any evidence for that.
I don't think it was going to, if it was a big cycle, the big bounce or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
it would have to go back to the original temperature it was in order to expand again, correct?
Yes, and that has its own problem. But even just, we're trying to figure out, can you rule out that it wouldn't contract at some point in the future? And so, well, what it would need to contract is it would need some kind of force that would cause things to contract again. There's not enough matter in the universe that we can see that would exert enough gravity to pull everything back together. It's kind of like when you fire some kind of a projectile into the air, like a cannonball. So off it goes, and it reaches kind of a maximum point, right? And then it comes back down. Now, that high point is going to be determined by how much energy it had at the beginning, and then the gravity of the Earth pulling on it. Now, if you fire it with enough energy, you can escape, you know, the Earth's gravity. If you have enough, you have the escape velocity, off it goes. Well, we can add up all of the stuff we can see in the universe and say, the universe didn't have, you know, there's not enough gravity there for it to not overcome that escape velocity. It's escaped that escape velocity. It's going to keep going as far as we know. There's nothing in the universe that's going to cause it to contract. You know, like to go back down with that cannonball. Sure. It should just keep going.
A lot of these questions are going to be part of your fine tuning as well, right?
Not so much. Yeah, part of it, because the expansion of the universe, the amount of stuff in the universe, is one of those fine tuning parameters. But I think, you know, we're going to have the end of the universe long before there's any kind of heat death. I think, you know, Jesus is going to return.
Oh, yeah, that's a given.
All of that. Lots of good questions.
Lots of good questions. 30 minutes of questions. That's phenomenal. But you're going to be talking again in 2 weeks on fine-tuning, and some of this language and lingo is going to be repeated, I think.
So now you're all prepared.
We're going to have to wrap up. I need some help putting the chairs back. But Sarah, thank you very much.